At the end of January, the association representing Quebec pharmacy owners issued a statement to its members urging them to refuse serving people covered under the interim federal health program. The result was that refugee claimants across Quebec were left without access to their prescription medications. On today's episode of the Health Justice Radio Collective, we look at how the conflict arose and at the complicity of Citizenship and Immigration Canada.
Listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
You're listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective. Today's show is a collaborative production between the Health Justice Radio Collective and Health on Earth in Montreal. Here's Health on Earth's Shannon Carter getting the details from David Thompson, a refugee lawyer at the Montreal Chest Institute.
All right, so Mr. Thompson, can you tell us what has happened here in Quebec between the Association Québécoise des Pharmaciens Propriétaires, Citizenship and Immigration Canada, and vulnerable migrant populations, including refugees and refugee claimants?
The Association of Pharmaciens Propriétaires, meaning pharmacy owners, passed a resolution. I don't know if it was in December, I think it might have been in December, in which they decided that they were no longer going to fill prescriptions for people who had who have federal interim health insurance. And what they would do instead would be to ask those people to pay themselves and then tell them to individually bill back to the federal interim health insurance program. The federal interim health insurance is something that's offered to people who have a reason to be in Canada legally, but do not have permanent residence or citizenship. The most obvious example are what we loosely call refugees, but in fact, it's a special class of refugees who are people who are requesting asylum in Canada. So they are not selected by through the entire process until they either get permanent residence or until they are deported. They are offered a basic form of health insurance, which provides for medical services, but also reimburses most of their pharmacy costs for essential medicines, and that's the Federal Interim Health Insurance Program. So the Association of Pharmacists set the date of January 17th for beginning to do this. And part of the problem, I think, was the Christmas holidays, but they also gave very little advance notice. There was perhaps a week's advance notice, and only really about two or three days, maybe 4 or 5 days of notice of exactly, definitively, what the association was planning to do. The association's grievances are many. One of the principal ones being is that when the pharmacist gives a medicine to someone who presents a prescription with federal interim health insurance, they then bill the federal government for the medicine and their dispensing fee. And the problem is that it's taking them really up to 6 months in most cases, and sometimes 9 months in some cases, and in the really extreme, very few, but every so often it's taken up to 3 years before they get reimbursed. So the impact of that is really as if the government of Canada was financing itself by borrowing interest-free money from the pharmacists, and I think they're quite angry about that. And justifiably so, to be honest with you, I think. But the other issue that was ongoing is that the insurance program had been run by a kind of private contractor who was nevertheless very closely associated with the government. It was situated in Alberta, and that contractor was called FTC. I don't actually know what the letters stand for. But all physicians in Montreal who had amongst their clientele people who had billed in the past to the federal insurance program received a letter after Christmas saying that Blue Cross was taking over also as of the 17th of January, and Blue Cross's services would be in New Brunswick. Well, in actual fact, what happened is that although a contract was given to Blue Cross did not put into place a functioning system that allowed the system to transfer seamlessly from FTC over to Blue Cross. The pharmacists, at least, are complaining that they don't have the forms on their computers, they don't know which medications are covered anymore by the insurance, and they don't know what percentage they're going to receive as a dispensing fee. So, again, I think that these issues are probably quite legitimate complaints. And it's really, I think, although the federal government, I think, has tried to position itself as sort of saying the pharmacists have an ethical duty to serve their clientele, and I think they probably do, but the federal government has kind of tried to position itself as being the innocent party here. But that's really not credible, because what has happened is... It's impossible that they had not foreseen that there would be a difficult transition period. It's really their job to exercise oversight and make sure that the transition occurs well and seamlessly. They failed to do so, and they showed remarkably little interest in this matter, in moving. They postured, but I suspect... although I don't have any proof of that, but I suspect that there are probably short-term financial interests that are at play that didn't give them a great deal of incentive to solve the problem extremely rapidly. So here at the Chest Hospital, people treat tuberculosis, they treat hepatitis C, they treat diabetes to a little bit, a certain extent, and they treat HIV, and the problem, there are multiple problems about interrupting drug supply for people. So in these three people worked all day long calling people, asking them how much medication do you have left, who's your pharmacist. Once we knew who the private pharmacist was, then they called the private pharmacist to see if the private pharmacist would issue at least 1 or 2 months' supply of medication before the January 17th deadline came. What happened is that they were only able to reach about half of the people on the list because people were at work, people were out, sometimes telephone numbers had changed. And some of the pharmacists accepted and some of them refused. Some of them had stopped serving the clientele even before the 17th. So there was a lack of discipline on the side of the pharmacists. They didn't really give people a chance, in some cases, to react. Then what happened is that over the course of the following weeks, week and a half or so anyways, maybe even 2 weeks, I think, at least, people straggled in bit by bit, one by one, saying, I've run out of medicine. And in some cases, the pharmacies were giving people a single day supply and saying, go to emergency. And that was ridiculous because the emergency ward doesn't stock that kind of quantities of medicine. And it's, you know, emergency wards are completely overrun. That was a problem. It became apparent after a few days that there was one or two pharmacies in the city that were refusing to follow the lease. And the problem, you know, TB treatment is something that you absolutely have to be faithful to, and you have to take it every day on TB. It's also very true of HIV. HIV medicine requires extremely high levels of compliance, resistance. The retrovirus begins to become resistant to the meds, when compliance falls below 95% of doses. So it requires, as I said, high levels of compliance. And studies have shown now, and these studies have been double-checked, we've known for at least 5 years, that from a large-scale public health point of view, there is absolutely no benefit to structured treatment interruptions, even treatment interruptions supervised by a physician. Globally, and from a public health point of view, there are absolutely no advantages. People don't live as long, their rates of morbidity are higher, and so you end up spending more money in the long run. So again, these kinds of interruptions are really, I found them to be kind of breathtakingly cavalier. And when you're on the front line and somebody comes into your office and they've got this little plastic box with, you know, three pills in it, and say the pharmacist gave me like 1 day's worth of meds, you just made, you know, the hair stand up on the back of my neck. And I was thinking, my God, I never thought I would live today to see the day when a significant group of people in Canada would be deprived access.
Indeed, it's pretty shocking that a huge group of people were completely deprived of access to medicines in Canada in this day and age. Speaking was David Thompson, who's a refugee lawyer at the Montreal Chest Institute. And up next, we have an interview with Dr. Samir Sahin Hussein, who's a pediatrician and organizer with No One Is Illegal in Montreal. So, Samir, you authored an op-ed that was signed by a long list of distinguished healthcare professionals that was published this past Tuesday in the Montreal Daily Le Devoir. In it, you wrote about the impasse that arose near the end of January between the Association of Quebec Pharmacy Owners and Citizenship and Immigration Canada, which left refugees and asylum seekers covered under the interim federal health plan without access to medicine. In your op-ed, you were very critical of both the pharmacy owners' tactics and Citizenship and Immigration Canada. I'm wondering if you can tell me about those two critiques that you had.
Sure. So first of all, I guess in terms of the AQPP, so the Association Québécoise des Pharmaciens Propriétaires, the critique is basically that they essentially held refugee claimants and other people who are covered by the interim federal health program hostage. I mean, they were basically used as a bargaining tool, as a pressure tactic, to in their negotiating strategy with Citizenship and Immigration Canada. And I mean, that's problematic on several levels, in the sense that obviously, and the most importantly being that the people who need medications, who are covered by the IFHP, were basically woke up to a situation where they couldn't get the medications that they needed and that they were and are entitled to. So that recourse of the AQPP is must be denounced, basically, categorically. And what we wanted to distinguish ourselves somewhat from the position that had been taken by other individuals and groups who made the argument that the AQPP's position is problematic because of the fact that it poses a public health risk and as well as a burden on the healthcare system because of the fact that if people wouldn't be able to get their prescriptions filled at pharmacies because these pharmacists were refusing to do so, then they would be deferred to emergency rooms, which are obviously already stretched thin. And while those arguments may or may not be valid, we wanted to somewhat separate ourselves from that and just make the bottom line argument that people are entitled to healthcare, and that's all it's about, regardless of whether there's an extra burden to the healthcare system or whether it's a public health risk. That's irrelevant. You know, someone has, let's say, this may or may not be the case, but let's say someone has an illness that's not an infectious disease and it's not a communicable illness, and they still need the medication, diabetes, for example. The fact that it's not a public health risk to not be treated doesn't justify in any way that their medication should be held. And one of the other points that we felt is important to make is that no other sector, no other group in society would ever be subjected to that kind of treatment. You know, I can't imagine people residing in Quebec who have coverage by the provincial government, the RAMQ. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine a situation where a pharmacist would all of a sudden say, okay, we're not going to serve you because we're having problems with the RAMQ in terms of our reimbursement. So the fact is that the only reason they were able to get away with this is because it is primarily refugee claimants and other recently arrived migrants that that fall under the IFHP program.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of the CIC question, Citizenship and Immigration Canada, I think the critique that is important to make is the fact that Citizenship and Immigration Canada's policies in general are anti-migrant, is what we wrote in the op-ed, and in my opinion, flagrantly racist in many as we can see in many ways over the years. And it's important to root that in a historical context, and the historical context is that the historical legacy of Citizenship and Immigration Canada is one that saw policies like the continuous journey policy that prevented South Asian migration to Canada in the early 1900s. The same legacy that that saw Chinese immigrants being prevented from coming here after they helped essentially build the railway. It's also the same, the same history that saw the policy of none is too many, which is sort of more of a de facto policy that prevented Jewish immigration during World War II. So that's sort of the historical context, and there's obviously all kinds of other examples that can be given, and it's important to root that in the present day, because the present day does see an ongoing violence against migrants, basically, including things like the Safe Third Country agreement between Canada and the United States that prevents migrants from making refugee claims here in Canada if they pass through or transited through the United States initially. There's all kinds of the Bill C, C-11, C-49, et cetera, that have policies that are basically being written in to immigration law that target migrants in a very significant way. And that, in turn, leads to migrant populations being further marginalized, and that obviously also has ultimately an effect on their health and their well-being. So CIC's role in the bigger picture is important to keep in mind, and specifically in this context, there's two points that are important to also keep in mind, which is that, one, it'd be really surprising that CIC didn't know the AQPP's grievances before this happened.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the AQPP presumably brought up a lot of these issues in the months and years before this. So why did CIC wait so long before trying to come to some kind of solution? And the other point with CIC specifically is that they've basically outsourced the management or the administration of this interim federal health program to a third party. Previously, it was FAS Benefit Administrators Limited, and as of January 17th, 2011, it is now Medavie Blue Cross. And that switchover essentially seems to be the timing of that. And when that happened is when the AQPP said, okay, that's it, we're not going to re-register basically with Medavie Blue Cross, allowing them to exert the pressure tactic that they ended up resorting to. But the fact of the matter is that CIC is the one who makes the decisions in terms of what gets covered under the IFH program in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And if people take the time to read what that is, there's, at least with the FAS Administrators Limited, the language was often very vague, and as a healthcare provider, it was often very unclear what was and what wasn't covered. The language that I remember stuck with me at when I originally studied the FAS Benefit Administrators Limited text was that they said that they would cover people, if IFH claimants with for emergency, in quotes, emergency and essential services.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine that, you know, it's quite vague, and it's not surprising in that circumstance that certain services would be rejected for reimbursement, thereby further, producing further precarity in terms of the people who are actually covered by the IFH program for healthcare coverage.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the other important points that we were hoping to highlight is to not exculpate CIC in this affair as if they're some kind of neutral party or even as if they're some kind of victim, because that's to a large extent how Jason Kenney, was the Minister of Immigration in Canada, was seemingly trying to play the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So in our opinion, the responsibility goes to both significantly to both parties, essentially.
If I'm not mistaken as well, pharmacists aren't the only ones who've complained about the length of time for reimbursement who have complained about the bureaucracy of IFHP, and presumably Citizenship and Immigration Canada is well aware of that. Can you tell me a little bit more about other problems that exist with IFHP?
Well, I mean, the problem, I guess, is sort of what I alluded to earlier, is and what you're mentioning, is that, the services that are covered are not necessarily always clear, and so the reimbursements that that healthcare providers are entitled to is not necessarily always guaranteed. So, for example, a physician may see someone for a follow-up, for a follow-up appointment of someone who has diabetes, let's say, and depending on what kind of code it fits into, at least, again, this is for sure, at least with FAS administrators when they were managing it,
mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be necessarily clear whether that would qualify as a service that can be rendered. So that's almost like a downstream sort of problem that's there. The other thing that's a reality with the IFHP is the sort of more structural effect it has, and I think that's important to highlight. In that, in certain clinics, even though IFH theoretically, the IFH coverage could be accepted, some clinics and some physicians and other healthcare providers would basically refuse because of the bureaucracy that it entails to get reimbursed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see that it's not even, it's not even to the point where the refugee claimant or whoever is under the IFH program is accessing healthcare services, and then the healthcare provider doesn't get reimbursed. In fact, in certain situations, what would end up happening would be that the people wouldn't even be able to get to the healthcare provider because there were these barriers that were set up before we can get to that point. And that's only possible because of a program like the IFH that essentially sets up a two-tier system within healthcare provision, so that one group of people has a separate mechanism of accessing healthcare compared to the rest of the population.
Mm-hmm. So effectively, I mean, people have been barred from accessing healthcare for a long time now. It's just that this is kind of the most acute manifestation of denial of health services.
Yeah, I think you can argue that this is the most acute in some ways and the most explicit, right? Like it was quite clear that for people covered by the IFHP in this circumstance, that if they went to certain pharmacies, they weren't going to get their prescriptions filled when they would present their IFHP coverage. Whereas in terms of the question of the other barriers I'm referring to, it's easier for, I'm sure, Citizenship and Immigration Canada to say, well, that's not our fault. That's the fault of the healthcare provider or the clinic or the hospital or whatever. So it's easier to pass the buck, and because it's somewhat more concealed, that barrier is concealed. Whereas in the case of the pharmacist, it was just so much more explicit. That being said, even the pharmacists, you know, they issued in their press releases, they had mentioned that, and you know, they're not refusing services. They're doing is that if there is someone who has IFH coverage, then they basically gave them three options. One is that the person would have to pay up front, and then the pharmacist would issue a receipt, and then the IFH beneficiary would basically send the receipt to CIC for reimbursement. That was option one. Option number two was that the pharmacist would basically defer or redirect the beneficiary to another hospital or an emergency department where they would be able to get the medication that they want. And option number three is what the previous status quo was, which is that they would fill it and then ask for reimbursement directly to the third-party payer. But, you know, the AQPP's position was basically to discourage option number three, and option number two doesn't really work in the sense of it's not easy for people to be redirected to an emergency department. They're going to have to wait hours, et cetera, et cetera. And option number one is frankly, completely disingenuous because if the pharmacist tells a person to pay and then that person can reimburse, that's actually a lie. Mm-hmm. Because the CIC, on CIC's website, it says very clearly after a release they sent out, I believe in late January, that individual beneficiaries cannot seek a reimbursement. So, you know, it's disingenuous at the very least in terms of what the AQPP's position is, and outright lying at its worst. So so that's something definitely I think that's important to highlight as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to get back to this, the idea of this parallel health system or a second-class health system, because I think that probably many people don't even know that there exists, you know, this two-tier thing that's happening. So I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about why is there a two-tier system?
That's, you know, worthwhile asking that, and that's one of the points that we bring up in our op-ed as well, is the fact that people basically, that whatever IFHP coverage is should be harmonized with provincial coverage and vice versa. And for people who don't have coverage, they should be at least covered by the IFHP until they are able to get provincial coverage. Because that brings up another important point, which is that I mentioned two-tiered, but in fact, there's actually three categories, because aside for people who are covered by the IFHP, who have, you know, more restricted access to healthcare, there's obviously people who are here who don't have any status at all. Mm-hmm. And for them, healthcare coverage healthcare access is a complete nightmare, obviously, because they're at the whim of healthcare providers and hospital administrators and clinics in terms of being able to access healthcare and then accessing medications is an even more difficult task. So those, you know, the reality for people who are basically underground or non-status is probably the reality that a lot of people who are working around health justice should be dealing with, because obviously they're the ones who are the most marginalized and need access to healthcare, especially in the context of you know, keeping in mind, because some of the arguments that are often come up in these kinds of situations is that, you know, they're not paying taxes and all these kinds of ridiculous arguments. And I think it's important to get around that by making the argument of just basic human dignity and justice. And then on that basis, everyone should be able to access healthcare.
That was Dr. Samir Sahin Hussein, a pediatrician and organizer with Known as Illegal in Montreal. We reached him last week. You are listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective, and today's production was a collective effort by Health on Earth in Montreal and the Health Justice Radio Collective here in Hamilton. We'll catch you next week.